This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 22nd of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Culture in association with Persol. Hello and welcome to the 154th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we've put everything in a bag and shaken it. There's rhyme and reason, of course, but you'll have to stand back at today's painting and consider it a little. Its charms are of the subtle kind. While resisting the urge to use the phrase Proustian rush, we'll meet Sean Street, the sound expert, who'll tell us why hearing is the most potent sense.
Human language becomes incandescent when it's powered by emotion. It becomes poetic, actually. And it lends it an extraordinary power that even visual pictures can't match.
We'll meet one of the world's most innovative and seemingly terribly uncomfortable comedians, the masterful Tim Key, will possibly stay out of character.
You know, you can sort of really lay into someone. So long as people are laughing and enjoying it, and the person knows that it's a joke, if there's a glint in your eye, then, in a way, the more brutal the better. It can be kind of quite spectacular.
And we'll listen in to Australian broadcaster ABC's new creative audio project, like we don't make our own, of course.
I think that now more than ever is the time to create audio that really commands people's attention and keeps them kind of riveted to their devices.
Plus, we'll meet the producers that have taken the dudish world of skateboarding overground. All this mayhem has taken the world by storm, one halfpipe at a time. And then, oh, you know, a session from none more yeehawish troubadour Willie Watson for this week's live Midori House session. It's a deal, it's a steal. It's all here to come on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. American musician Willie Watson is very much of the It Ain't Broke school of thought, having been a founding member of old-time country and roots music act, the Old Crow Medicine Show, a band whose folky nostalgia is allegedly responsible, or to blame, some might say, for inspiring a slew of waistcoated new country bumpkin types such as Mumford and Sons. Willie is now striking out on his own and recently stopped by Midori House, banjo in hand, to play some traditional tunes from his recent album of cover versions, titled Folk Singer Volume 1. We'll hear from Willie later on in the show, but first of all, here he is with Keep It Clean.
I ran to the river, I couldn't get across. Jumped on your papa cause I thought he was a horse. Now ride him over, give him a Coca-Cola, lemon soda, sauce of ice cream, take soap and water for to keep it clean. Up she jumped, down she fell, her mouth flew open like a mussel shell. Now ride it over, give a Coca-Cola, lemon soda, sauce of ice cream, take soap and water for to keep it clean. You got to put on your collar and your TIE. Now ride him over, give him a Coca-Cola, lemon soda, saucer of ice cream, take soap and water for to keep it clean. If you wanna get the rabbit out the L-O-G, you got to put on a stump like a D-O-G. Now ride him over, give him a Coca-Cola, lemon soda, sauce of ice cream, take soap and water for to keep it clean. So your sister was a teddy, your daddy was a bear, put that muzzin on your mama cause she had bad hair. Now ride her over, give a Coca-Cola, lemon soda, sauce of ice cream, take soap and water for to keep it clean. So doctor, run here fast. Tell me what's the matter with her? Yes, 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 now. Ride her over, give her Coca-Cola, lemon soda, saws of ice cream, take soap and water, for to keep it clean. Take soap and water, for to keep it clean.
That was Willie Watson with Keep It Clean, and more of him later on, as ever. Now we're going to hit rewind and explore our past through the sense of sound. The Memory of Sound, Preserving the Sonic Past, is a new book by professor, writer and broadcaster Sean Street. It takes a look at the way we connect to our memories through what we hear, with a particular focus on radio broadcast, but also touching upon music and the noises that make up everyday life. There might be emotional connections, or some noises could set a memorable scene. Which song reminds you of the summer after you finished school? Where were you when you heard the reports of 9/11. My producer Holly Fisher wound her hearing aid back 20 odd years and invited Sean into the studio to delve into the sonic past.
A significant memory that opens this book is me as a 7 or 8 year old boy listening to the radio science fiction series Journey into Space.
October the 19th, 1965. In the Australian outback, many miles from the nearest town, stands the rocket ship that is about to carry Jet Morgan and his crew to the moon. Beside Jet, the captain, there are Stephen Mitchell, engineer, Lemmy Barnett, radio operator, and Doc Matthews. That's me.
Journey into Space was actually the last British evening radio program to beat television to the ratings. It was that popular. In 1953, we're talking. It was a science fiction series written by Charles Chilton, and it was set in the distant future of 1965, when an all-Commonwealth space crew would be the first people to land on the moon. That was the story. That was the way it started. But the point of me remembering that is that I'm remembering also the situation in which I was when I heard it. I was sitting, lying in bed in my grandmother's house in Portsmouth in a terraced house. And as soon as I invoke the memory of listening to that, I can put myself then back into that place, into that bedroom. And I can hear her chickens at the bottom of the garden. And I can hear the trains shunting on the railway line just beyond the back of the garden. And then I can hear a murmur of adult voices downstairs from my grandparents and my father and my aunts and uncles talking. And out of that comes all this chain of memory, which is triggered by me almost like a mantra, almost like some kind of meditation, focusing on that radio broadcast and that radio memory.
How much of it do you think is actual memory, and how much of it do you think is your imagination conjuring up things that you think you remember, or maybe pulling moments from your past altogether into one moment, whereas maybe they might not have all happened at the same time?
Well, I think that's a good and complex question, because it's a conversation I had with Rob Perks at the British Library, who is head of oral history there. And he said, well, you know, I told him that story about Journey into Space. And he said, well, yes, we need to sit down and really analyse whether you're actually remembering the actual sounds or whether the memory is triggering certain circumstances. In a sort of way, I don't think it matters. Probably I'm not hearing the actual sounds, but I know there were chickens at the bottom of the garden. I know there were trains, and I know those sounds were audible from that room. What it does, and this is why I say I don't think it actually fully matters whether I'm hearing the real sounds in my mind, what it does is unlocks that time for me.
And what do you think it is about sounds that can evoke these memories compared to other senses?
I think sounds have the most potential. Some people would say smell also is very evocative, and I would agree with that. But I think sounds have the possibility for us of a memory source that takes you by surprise. It's like hearing a song, you know, a song you haven't heard for ages.
Songs are something that you'll hear over and over again, and you'll say, oh, I love that song, it reminds me of blah, blah, blah. But a broadcast is maybe something, and this is something you touch upon in your book, that happens and you might never ever hear again. Do you think these are sort of different types of memories that you associate with these different types of sounds?
I quote Proust quite a lot in the book. It's hard not to, really. And he talks about voluntary memory and involuntary memory. And it's the involuntary memory that's the real key to sound, I think. I think in music, it's easy to overplay them, I think. And I think that's something that can happen. There are certain songs that I haven't heard for years that I suddenly hear and I'm back there. It might be Motown, it might be, I don't know, the Beatles. But I think the danger with gold stations that play all the hits and more all the time, or your local radio station that inevitably plays lots of a playlist. If the playlist is too small, the song that was from your past, you hear so many times now, it becomes part of your present. So it loses that power to shock you back into the past. But then take a song, an album track maybe that you haven't heard, that doesn't get played that much airtime, and suddenly, you know, where did that come from? You know, that can happen.
Now that we're sort of bombarded with so many ways to consume news, what is it about a radio broadcast, maybe over reading something on the news, maybe on the internet, that makes it more memorable?
Yeah, it's that you remember where you were when syndrome, really, isn't it? And it's because perhaps with radio, you are doing something else maybe while you're listening. You know, it's this secondary activity and primary activity. And you might be peeling the potatoes, getting ready for lunch or something, and the radio is on in the background, and the radio is the secondary activity. And then suddenly something's said, something happens, and peeling the spuds becomes the secondary activity, and radio becomes the first activity. So you remember exactly where you were. The obvious example, I suppose, and I quote it in the book, is 9/11. And a producer I work with a lot, Andy Cartwright, remembered being at home working and having the television on and seeing that unfold. And at the same time, his partner was driving back from a conference in the car, listening to it on the radio. And when they got home, obviously there was only one topic of conversation. She had grasped the human scale of this thing much more than he had, because he'd been fed the images. And that's what television does. It gives you the images and it tells you this is what's happening. Whereas radio has this ability to talk subliminally to you and allow you to create the images and allow you to interpret what's going on. And of course, radio is great at telling stories. And what was coming out of the radio as Andy's partner was coming back in the car were stories. And it's down to telling stories and not just the facts, but the tone of voice. You know, human language becomes incandescent when it's powered by emotion. And it becomes poetic, actually. And it lends it an extraordinary power that even pictures, visual pictures that you see physically, can't match.
So do you think then that there's set criteria for what makes a memorable broadcast?
And I think sometimes DJs forget the power they wield or can wield. And too often their presentation hasn't got that much thought in it. But often when it does, a good presenter can take you aback and take you to a new place and take you to something you never thought of. An example from my own background, I was listening to a commercial radio station many, many years ago. And they played David Gates and Bread and Everything I Own, the song Everything I Own, which I'd known for years. It's a pleasant ballad. It's quite bland, but yeah, it's a nice sort of song. I'd always thought of it as a sort of rather bland love song. And then the presenter at the end of it said, David Gates wrote that song after the death of his father. And then I thought back to the words, I would give everything I own just to have you back again. And suddenly that song became much more profound. And ever after that, when I hear that song, it moves me deeply because I can relate to it now in a way that I couldn't have done before. And so I remember that moment, and I remember the station, and I remember the presenter, and it was something that was achieved in maybe about 15 seconds. I think the best radio makes pictures here. And it's the pictures that you retain. It's those. It might be a pattern of words, or it might be a visual image that's transcribed into the mind, or it can be, of course, a song, or even just a pure sound. The other thing I think is that's really interesting about sound and how it takes you aback, and this question of nostalgia, is that it's constantly reinventing itself. Obviously, one of the things I play in my presentation is the sound of a dial-up modem. It's not that long ago that familiar sound was
the everyone knows it.
Everybody knows it.
Sound.
But most of us have now moved on and forgotten it. So to play that again shocks you back into, oh, gosh, yes, I remember. But I couldn't have told you about that had you not played it, you know. So it's a bit like the playwright Samuel Beckett says, the man with perfect memory never remembers because he never forgets. The shock of memory is when you remember something that you thought you'd forgotten.
That was writer and Professor Sean Street speaking to Monocle's Holly Fisher. And after the break, we'll get lost in the thoughts of comedian Tim Key.
Indigo and lavender are the ingredients for success for two entrepreneurs based in Wales. We travel through Valley and Dale to meet a jeans maker and a lavender farmer getting it right.
It turned out, you know, everybody loved to come and actually see lavender oil being distilled right here in Wales. So somehow there's a holistic thing going on here that's about the lavender, about distilling, and about a way of life in these hills.
Made in Wales, now playing in the films menu at monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Tim Key is a man who approaches comedy and perhaps life from a slightly different angle to most. You may recognise him from his turn on the big screen as Alan Partridge's sidekick in the recent Alpha Papa film, but it's his wildly ambitious and creative live stand-up shows that are really making waves, where many comedians are content to either detail the minute observations of their daily life, embark on misanthropic flights of fancy, or simply bemoan exactly how middle class they've become. Tim Key truly pushes the boundaries of what can be done in the world of stand-up comedy, with a new show on tour entitled Single White Slut that takes in video, dance, poetry, some excruciating audience participation and no small quantity of alcohol. Tim came into the Monocle Studios with nothing but his collection of poetry on a selection of pornographic playing cards for a sit-down with Monocle's Paul Noble.
I saw your show in Edinburgh a few weeks ago. I absolutely loved it. We have to start with just the moment you come in, because it's unexpected. I walked in and there you were, sitting on a bed,
yep,
in a denim onesie, huge flowing beard, flicking playing cards around like a man waiting on death row.
Yeah.
It was quite an unsettling opening to a show.
Was it? Well, the aim of that is to put people at ease.
Right.
So that worked.
Well, that worked.
Actually, it's mainly to put myself at ease. I mean, it was genuinely self-preservation was how it started, but I've never really sort of thought what audiences think. I suppose, what's it like being an audience member?
There's just a deep fear that you're going to get pulled up on stage and
is
made
there?
To sit on a bed.
Oh, I would never do that. I do that.
Oh, you do that.
Yeah, that's the main part of the show. Yeah. No, but I don't mean to unsettle you, Paul.
It didn't unsettle me, but it certainly put a sort of air of tension in the air.
Yeah.
And it feels very crafted and particular. You're not wandering around with the mic whipping the cable around you doing observations. It's a very crafted show with elements of dance and choreography, film, a lot of sound design. How much effort do you put into crafting these shows?
I mean, obviously there's some effort goes in. I mean, I would like to say, you know, I'd like to be one of those guys who kind of can ace an exam and say, nah, not really, just sort of got lucky. But no, it's not really like that. I kind of spend quite a lot of time writing. And then I do quite a lot of getting it ready.
No,
I do it with an audience.
Right.
So I tend to, with that show, I guess I started doing it maybe a year or two ago, I guess. The way I did it was I had an idea. That's the sort of most important thing, I think. There's a little idea. And then because of the idea, I knew I needed to have a bed. So got a bed, mm-hmm. and then wrote loads of stuff that was to do with beds. and gradually built it up into, so I had lots of stuff. And then, yeah, what you're talking about, I suppose, kind of working out how it all fits together, that's a mixture of trying really hard to make it fit together and then having a moment where suddenly something just fits together and you kind of get lucky and a bit now works that didn't before. So I think I work really hard trying to make it work, and then I think in the end it does work, but I don't know how much the two things are related.
Well, the effect is very slow and hypnotic, and you really had the audience exactly where you wanted them. Suddenly you're appearing up in the rafters, 10 rows back. You're on a bed. You're not on the bed anymore. I was wondering, how important is it for you to have control of the audience? And, you know, if you have suddenly hecklers or people trying to butt into the show.
Yeah, I think it's healthy that you're the main one just for that hour. If someone else is sort of the main person, then something's gone a bit wrong. But there's room, you know. You can have a show where, you know, something can happen and there can be, you know, sort of characters floating around in the room who are kind of part of the show. And I think what you say is right. It just, the important thing is that you are in control. So if you've got some guy who's just, you know, gone mental and let himself down and sort of started crying because he couldn't say what he needed to say, then that's fine, so long as the audience, I think it's important that the audience are watching thinking he's controlling all this. Even if there's a heckler, it doesn't matter. As long as the audience are watching and thinking he's enjoying having that guy there, then it's fine. The moment where the audience are thinking, oh dear, problems, then the show will rapidly descend into a survival situation. You know, you can sort of really lay into someone, I find. And so long as people are laughing and enjoying it and the person knows that it's a joke, if there's a glint in your eye, then in a way, the more brutal, the better. It can be kind of quite spectacular.
Looking at your presence on Twitter, you've got Tim Key Person and Tim Key Poet. And there seems, during the show, to be a tension between Tim Key, who is a bloke in front of us, who we recognise as, you know, a man of English origin. Mm. And then there's a Tim Key character, which is a sort of very sharp, and there's almost a sort of Brechtian divide where you can cross that line. Mm. And I was wondering where, clearly you've got a theatre, an interest in theatre. And there is a lot of drama takes place in the show.
Brecht. Why is he asking about Brecht? Trying to promote my show. Now, the guy's saying, Brecht, wants to know about this Brechtian schism between my actual me. It was kind of a character, I think. I mean, I wore an ill-fitting suit covered in lager. Brecht, I remember from theatre studies. I did theatre studies. And we had to... What was it? There was Stanislavski. The actor prepares. And then Edward Gordon Craig, Uber Marionette. And then Brecht was doing stuff where he'd put stuff up. It'd say what he was going to do with sidebars. There are bits where it goes off in sort of that direction of this kind of, there's a guy there who's kind of obscene and quite alarming and menacing, and someone that you wouldn't necessarily want you to align yourself with. And then it also in the mix, like you say, you can just sort of chat away with someone in a kind of advanced version of yourself. I mean, I talk to, like you say, I kind of invite people up and we sort of chat on the bed. And the only real difference is that I'm sort of more confident than in real life. That having that wing to it, the kind of a little bit more of me in it, does allow you to sort of be able to do slightly different things. You can do slightly more interesting things. I think you can talk about stuff which is slightly more unacceptable and sell it in a slightly more charming way, where people kind of think, I don't know, people can sort of take it, enjoy it, laugh at it, and then a few seconds later think, oh, hang on, that was horrible. But no, I've never had a moment where I've felt, oh, shouldn't have done that.
You're a gracious host.
Yeah, I'm a gracious host. Yeah. This is my aim.
And I was watching a film the other night called The Double.
Oh, wow.
Very enjoyable.
Was
and,
it?
And all of a sudden, up pops a very clean-shaven Tim Key. And we have to talk about your the other side to your work, which is your film roles and your acting. Because in your comedy work, you've got a very particular and sort of single-minded worldview. How easy is it for you to slip into someone else's work and their world and just deliver the role as an actor?
Well, it sort of depends on what you're doing, really. I mean, I've been fairly lucky, I think, that I've been asked to do things that are quite interesting and quite good.
He's watched The Double last night. So that would be because he's interviewing me today and he's tried to work out whether I've actually done anything. And he's saying that I popped up, but it doesn't make sense that he would watch The Double apropos of nothing and then interview me the next day and I've just popped up. Must be the other way around, that he's seen that I'm in The Double and then he's found it weird that I'm not in it that much.
Because actually, I might not be able to do it that way and it might work out worse for both of us. And I think with someone like Richard, he sort of goes, okay, you sort of do your thing. And that kind of works out best for both of us. No one gets hurt. And it's not as good as having an actual actor, but at least it's sort of something that you can work with.
And cheaper.
It's a lot cheaper, yeah. I didn't pay that much to be in that film.
I wanted to talk about Russia, because when I was sort of researching some of your work beyond the stuff that I'd seen, I found a documentary called Gogol's Overcoat, which you made for the BBC Radio 4. You mentioned it in your shows as well. You've got a quite a deep interest in Russia and have spent time there.
Yeah, but weirdly.
How did that all start?
Well, I don't know, really. Well, I do, actually. I had a year out, you know, like some people do, after finishing my A-levels and before university. And somehow, me and my friend were going to go and travel around America, we were going to go to.
The overcoat. I guess the idea is that he's somehow this guy... somehow googled stuff that I've done and now has listened to, he's tried to find somehow, he's tried to find something that might be interesting for me, because I don't think he will know that I've done this, and he's thinking, I guess, that he wants to show that he's into what I do by not just talking about the Alpha Papa stuff, but by talking about this obscure documentary. Fair play. If he's got through it, then he's got through it, and I should talk to him.
And then stopped doing anything to do with Russia when I was finished university.
Single White Slut, I greatly enjoyed it, and I would recommend anyone goes and sees it while you're on tour. Could you possibly give us a little taster in the form of a poem, one of your...
Oh, right.
One of your little...
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe that's
Do you
possible.
Have any?
Yeah, I do have some in my bag. Well, have you got the dates of the tour? Because you could maybe cover me getting my poem.
Okay. I'll fill.
Yeah, you can fill. Well, I mean, I just literally, it's in my bag there.
Okay. I'll start talking.
People can get tickets from theinvisibledot.com.
Well, it's on the 23rd of September in Colchester at the Arts Centre.
Just going to go and get them now.
It's in Bristol at the Tobacco Factory on the Thursday the 25th. Then you've got a couple of days off. Saturday 27th is in Cambridge. Sunday 28th will be in Lancaster.
The Dukes.
The Dukes, yeah, that's right. 29th is in Sheffield at the Crucible. Quite a room to play, quite prestigious.
Yeah, it's the studio.
Oh, it's the studio, okay. Then the 30th is a Tuesday and you're in Manchester in the Dance House.
That's filled plenty.
Effectively.
So now it's a case of, I mean, here's the poems.
That's a lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, this is the show.
This is a big stack of playing cards.
Yeah.
And a tiny stack, and that's the show.
That's the show, is those cards. Yeah.
Okay.
Hello?
Ooh.
And then these are new, and then these are just sort of, I just sort of grabbed some.
Let's just throw fate to the wind and pull a card out and see what happens.
I'm going to do the top card.
Okay.
A leg floated by. Repulsed, Helen spewed into the lagoon. I kept on steering towards the caves and cursing Lun Polly under my breath. I suppose that fits in with your magazine, doesn't it? You've got sort of a travel element.
That was comedian Tim Key with Monocle's Paul Noble. And as you just heard, his show Single White Slut is currently touring. Find out more at invisibledot.com. Still to come in part two, more of Willie Watson and his banjo in this week's Midori House session. We find out how Australian radio is nurturing creativity, and Monocle's Tom Hall goes back to his skater roots when he meets the producers behind new documentary hit All This Mayhem. That's all here to come on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Before we head to Australia, let's have some more music. Willie Watson is playing songs from his record Folk Singer Volume 1. And after the singing was done, he sat down with Monocle's Tom Hall to talk about the enduring appeal of his finger-picking favourites and also how to pick a good hat. But before we hear that, here he is performing Mexican Cowboy.
Man, that's an old Fort Worth in 1883.
We're very lucky to be joined by Willie Watson on Monocle 24, who has just played three pretty raucous, kind of folky country, am I allowed to say bluegrass? Is that the right kind of genre?
Sure, there's definitely some bluegrass in there.
I mean, there's years and decades of tradition in those songs, and you come from kind of a world of keeping the sort of folk and country kind of tradition alive. You did a lot of work with Old Crow Medicine Show. And people kind of look to that act as having maybe inspired a sort of revival in that music. Do you see you guys in that band as being responsible for, you know, all the Mumford and Sons and all that banjo kind of music coming back at the moment?
I don't know if I want to say responsible. That's a big responsibility. Marcus is a pop songwriter in a lot of respects, and he has said that we've influenced that band, and I believe it. But he's definitely thrown in a lot more modern pop sensibilities, which we, you know, me and with Old Crow too, we had that sensibility, but it wasn't quite as modern. Our modern sensibility maybe went as far as 1975.
And your music that you're making is kind of rooted in tradition, but growing up, was, you know, that traditional bluesy, country-ish kind of sound, was that the only thing that influenced you, or were you listening to other stuff as well?
Yeah, not at all. I was listening to everything else that kids my age were listening to at the time. With a few exceptions, I was into more of the alternative music scene, bands like the Pixies, and Nirvana came along, and that, you know, I liked Nirvana a lot. So I was listening to that, but at the same time, listening to Neil Young and Bob Dylan and my dad's record collection. And he had, you know, he was a child of the 60s and he had all the Stones and the Beatles records. So I'd been listening to that, you know, since I was could ever remember. I was taking it all in, you know, and it didn't take me long playing Neil Young songs and Bob Dylan that didn't take me long to figure that I liked acoustic music. So I put down the electric guitar and picked up that acoustic guitar. And that just sort of sent me on my way. And you kind of just keep going back and listen to where Bob got his influences. And then you get to Woody Guthrie. And, you know, you just, if you're into it, you can't help but figure it out.
But you don't think it's retro? You don't think it's kind of just plundering the past?
No, I don't think of it as retro. I mean, if it's retro, it's like the ultimate retro. I mean, I guess we could go back to Renaissance times and start get out the lutes. In the harps. Maybe that's next.
I must tell listeners that you do look a very authentic figure because you've got a kind of almost like a cowboy hat and it's got an authentic sweat patch across the top, which I was very impressed with when I first saw you.
Yeah, I've been wearing this thing for a while and I've broken it in pretty good.
Should we give a shout out to whoever makes those hats? What hat
are
you wearing?
Actually, I get a lot of inquiries about this hat. People find my phone number and they call me up. And they asked me where I got my hat. Total strangers every day. So if I told everybody where I got this hat, then I think everybody would have it. So I'm going to keep it a secret.
Okay. Have you got any tips for people who are looking for a good hat? What should be a good quality in a hat?
If it looks good, buy it.
That is sound advice.
And I quote that from Mr. Peter Rowan.
That was Willie Watson speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall. Folk Singer Volume 1 is out now on Akeney Records and he's currently touring across the USA. Head to williewatson.com for all your Willie Watson needs. This is Culture on Monocle 24 and I'm Robert Bounds. Earlier on, we spoke about how radio can provoke memories. But what about the process that goes into making an effective broadcast? ABC Radio National's Creative Audio Unit was launched this summer as a space for imaginative storytelling. It welcomes not only Australian radio makers, but international ones too. The unit currently operates two weekly programmes called Radio Tonic, a story-driven slot for both fiction and non-fiction, and Soundproof, a sonically rich programme with room for soundscape and performance. The idea is to nurture creativity in sound, bring art to the airwaves, and invite the audience to take a closer listen. Monocle's Adrian Craddock meets Julie Shapiro, the Creative Audio Unit's executive producer.
The unit is sort of continuing in the legacy that ABC has always shown towards supporting more creative works and honoring the fact that radio can be an art form unto itself as well as a very crucial delivery mechanism for information and news. A couple of years ago, the organization went through some cuts, and at the other end of that, there was a recognition that there was this opportunity to kind of start from scratch and continue the legacy, but also reform a unit that could be in the now, in the present, take on the digital age, take on a sort of increasing bravery and excitement in audio storytelling and sound art, you know, with digital technologies making the international connections just so ripe and flourishing everywhere. I think ABC recognized that now was the time to really take a chance and invite people to come and start making new kinds of work.
Is that a challenge in the sense that traditionally radio is made with the idea that people can kind of dip in and out, that it can often be in the background? You know, this idea of creating radio that's meant to be listened to closely, does that change the way that the programs are made?
In the digital age, now is the best time, I think, for producers to be making very craft-driven and complex and, you know, sound-rich work because, of course, anyone can listen at any time in headphones, so people are listening very carefully on their own terms. It is challenging, of course, to bring people into focus for long form programs, but we're sort of seeing the whole audio culture shift toward appointment listening and people coming along and really expecting to give full attention to something, whether they're exercising or, you know, doing the dishes or taking walks. I think that now more than ever is the time to create audio that really commands people's attention and keeps them kind of riveted to their devices.
Is it just about the production value? Is it about, you know, playing with sounds in ways that people haven't before and playing with production values in ways that haven't been done before? Or is it also the tone of the content and really putting the magnifying glass on really left of center stories that otherwise wouldn't get the kind of time that your shows devote to them?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I think everything is possible to do on the shows, whether it's, you know, a story you've heard before told in a new way or a story you've never heard before. I think there's kind of a secret sauce with a lot of the stories that we're going to find working best and best representing the two programs. And we're figuring that out right now. It's a really exciting process because we're getting a lot of pitches. There's a lot of interest in contributions, there's a lot of interest in contributing, which is great because we really want to reach out and collaborate as widely as possible. But we're also starting to understand which stories kind of at a gut level feel appropriate, especially for Radiotonic, which is more narrative. I would say that all stories are possible contenders for the shows, but the treatment, whether it's very careful production or a certain tone, we're running a series right now that is called Frozen Garbage, Deep Thoughts on Shallow Subjects. And someone might consider that, you know, kind of empty in a way, but I find it actually brilliant and full of wisdom and kind of just quirky enough.
I found myself saying, I'm in a good place.
Are you being a bit literal?
Where is this place?
You could have...
Are you in a good place?
Who talks about it?
Everyone. Everywhere.
Politicians?
Everyone.
Why?
Or they're in a good or bad space.
A bit too spacey.
It panicked me.
Like twerking?
Twerk? I think it's more like twerp.
You are trying to ruffle some feathers, I would suggest. Like you're trying to, you know, change things about the radio form. Is that a fair assessment?
I think what we're trying to do is introduce people to new ways of thinking about what radio can do. So yeah, I think there will be some ruffled feathers. I mean, we put a 10-minute piece that was an homage to Ligeti, the composer, and it was all about indeterminacy. And it was basically clocks ticking in and out of phase, you know, hypnotic, mesmerizing, I think, maybe not everyone's cup of tea. And it was surrounded by two very narrative stories, even on Soundproof. So for me, the Holy Grail is to provide texture for people, something they can think about, something they want to talk about the next day, whether they're blown away, whether they're confused, whether they're empowered somehow through what they hear, whether it opens up ideas for them about ways they think about life or stories they want to tell. I do think we'll get to the point where everything's not for everyone, but I think that opens windows for really bringing people along in what they expect and helping the whole culture of audio and radio evolve in a way.
That was Julie Shapiro, executive producer of ABC's Creative Audio Unit, speaking to Monocle's Adrian Craddock. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. After the break, we're slouching our trousers, growing our hair, and digging out our skateboards, dude. Stay tuned.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging, and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features, and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
You're listening to Culture on Monocle 24, and I'm Robert Bounds. In the mid-1990s, as skateboarding burst into the mainstream, two of the most unpredictable and perhaps unlikely heroes of the scene were Australian brothers Tass and Ben Pappas. The duo, who rose from a broken home in the obscurity of the Melbourne suburbs, travelled to the USA to compete against skateboarding's biggest names, such as Tony Hawk, and on more than one occasion, the brothers rattled the sport's USA-centric hierarchy by occupying the number one and two ranking spots. But success came at a cost for the Pappas brothers, and despite their enormous talents, their careers were cut short by drug use and prison time. Ben Pappas died in 2007, aged just 28. The story of these two young lives lived on the edge is a topic of new documentary All This Mayhem, directed by Eddie Martin and co-produced by Martin, George Pank and James Gay Rees. George and James recently stopped by Midori House to talk about the film with Monocle's Tom Hall.
I don't want the Pappas brothers to be remembered as just maniacs. Growing up was pretty hectic. It was me and Ben against the world. We're always looking for a rush, smashing things or finding a stolen car. That's what everyone does, don't they? Didn't they?
Eddie Martin is an Australian filmmaker. Eddie was the originator of the project. Eddie was a skateboarder and he was in the scene in Paran, which is an inner city area of Melbourne, Australia. He sort of went on a different trajectory than the Pappas brothers, but they were unique in the sense that they made it to America and they became pros and then, you know, they reached incredible highs and then they spun out of control and incredible lows as well. And so he kind of was privy to it and a lot of his close friends were as well. So he was a filmmaker. He'd made two films. And I think this story has so many big elements in it, such, you know, huge kind of thematic things, brotherhood and loss and redemption. And so I think he as a filmmaker could see its potential.
Much of the film is in this sort of past perspective telling the story. Did you find that there was almost sort of too much footage to wade through, or were you having to really try and source it from strange places?
There wasn't too much. The reality with a lot of these skaters, because it was quite a long time ago, you know, talking about the 80s and the 90s, is that some of them did have it and some of them couldn't locate it and, you know, or didn't want to give it up. Because it's, as George said, it's a very kind of introverted sort of subculture sort of scene, obviously, and it's because Eddie was directing it. And because it was about Taz, there were a lot of legitimate components in the team. It wasn't like a bunch of complete outsiders coming in saying, right, we want to just come in and exploit your scene, as it were. So there was a lot of trust there. But I think it's fair to say that in the course of his journey, Taz had also pissed quite a lot of people off. So it wasn't always a slam dunk that you were going to get the material you wanted. We made a film called Senna as well. And unlike Senna, where we stopped archiving at 5,000 hours because we just couldn't take it anymore, this, we pretty much use almost every single frame which is available to us in one shape or form.
The brothers, they really sort of scaled the heights of the skateboarding scene in the 90s. They were ranked one and two in the world for a bit. Did that translate back in Australia? Were they sort of national heroes for a bit before it obviously went pear-shaped a bit?
With non-mainstream sports, if you're a champion swimmer, if you're a champion cricket player or a champion rugby player or AFL football, you're an absolute hero, and we worship our sporting heroes like no other country. But if you're part of a subculture like skateboarding, which wasn't really accepted, and it was kind of like, it had its moment when it was a bit of a fad, but to be real, like, people looked at it like a fad, like yo-yo or something. And I think the Australian culture can be even more exclusive. Like, in America, you know, it was a bigger thing, and even in the UK, I think subculture is a little bit more accepted. There's more, perhaps less conservative, but you were an outsider there. So the Pappas brothers, no, apart from people deep within that scene who knew of them, no one knew that they'd become what they'd done, what they'd achieved, that they'd become world champions. And then once Ben got, it's a story point, but once he got caught with cocaine, you know, that really stigmatized him. So it was like, nah, their names were kind of sullied in a way.
They became impossible to deal with.
Right there, it was when it started to go sour.
I was shut out. ESPN and the X Games ran the whole show.
Turned into, like, a personal war.
And there were casualties.
Ben Pappas will never be allowed back into the United States to compete.
I was shattered. I felt like I failed him. I realised right then and there who I was up against.
I mean, I know that the story took place just as it was really crossing over into the mainstream and really becoming this profitable sort of, you know, ESPN sort of juggernaut. But if the story was taking place today, where all the skaters seem to almost be kind of media trained from day one and treated like legitimate athletes, do you think Ben and Taz would have ended up in a slightly better place maybe?
But I think there is this conflict at the heart of skateboarding, which is, on the one hand, it has become massive business. It's a bit like football in the way, you know, you've got the kind of the fans who are into it, and then you've got the kind of people who are into making money out of it. And in skateboarding, it's clearly, you've got the subculture part of it, which is what it's really all about. And then obviously you've got this huge machine, whether it's merchandising or kind of broadcasting or competitions, that to some extent sort of exploits that. No, I think if they were around today, they'd probably find it maybe even harder, because everything is bigger business today and they are who they are. You know, they were never going to become these kind of like corporate patsies or kind of toe the line. It's just not in their DNA. And so what they were railing against then is actually even worse today. But I think it's still very much confined to the States, you know. I mean, in the UK and Australia, it's bigger than it was and it's very popular, but the money and the kind of profile is definitely in the States. So they still probably would have wanted to go to the States because that's where the action is. And, you know, they had to survive, so they had to try and make money out of it. But they were always at odds with the system and, you know, the methodology that the system employed.
If I didn't win, I just wanted to be known as the guy who went completely ballistic.
Look at that! Just going giant. Oh my goodness!
That was George Pank and James Gay Rees speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall. And All This Mayhem is available on iTunes now. And I think it's still in some selected cinemas too. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Next time we're going analogue with a show about handwriting. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Holly Fisher. And she wrote this script in her own fair hand in preparation for next week. That's why I've made so many stumbles and mistakes. Thanks, Holly. Thanks a lot. Time for one final song from Willie Watts. This is Rock, Salt and Nails. Thanks for tuning in.
On the banks of the river, where the willows hang down, and the wild birds all warble with a low moaning sound, way down in the hollow, where the water runs a cold, that's where I first listened to the lies that you told. Now I lie on my bed and I see your sweet face, and the past I remember, time cannot erase. And the letter you wrote me was written in shame. I know that your conscience still echoes my name. Now the nights are so long and sorrow runs deep, and nothing is worse than a night without sleep. I walk out alone and look at the sky, too empty to sing, too lonesome to cry. Now if you ladies were blackbirds, if few ladies were thrushes. I'd lie there for hours in the cold, chilly marshes. A few ladies would squirrel with high, bushy tails. I'd fill up my shotgun with rock, salt, and nails.